Hey Osiris listeners, we want to tell you about our friends at Sunset Lake CBD who support this show. Sunset Lake CBD is a Vermont hemp farm crafting affordable CBD products designed to help with sleep and stress without breaking the bank. If you haven't tried CBD before, take it from me, it's a game changer. I use Sunset Lake's tincture every night before I go to bed, helping me get solid, restful sleep. And their gummies are great for daytime. Check out their new Good Vibes gummies, which have just a bit of hemp-derived THC to help you relax and unwind. Sunset Lake CBD crafts products with hemp grown on their family farm and ships them directly to customers. They have tinctures, salves, edibles, coffee, smokables, and even pet products. By the way, their CBD chocolate fudge is awesome. Check them out today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use coupon code TIME for 20% off all products. Sunset Lake CBD, farmer-owned, Vermont-grown.
Osiris. Loyalty described as, do you care? And I care, and that's why I'm on this show. Comes a time, here we go.
I'm a sucker for O'Teal, man. It's all that same feeling that I have, that what he filled a void that I didn't even know existed.
It feels so good to, as Ben said, to try to do something about an issue as opposed to complaining.
If you can't help, don't hurt.
If we could just all get out there and throw cream puffs at each other, maybe things, instead of bullets and angry words, it would be better.
When you stop laughing, you stop living.
There's a worldwide surge in interest in mushrooms.
It was deep, man.
It's not that TM makes your mind quiet down there. It already is. We're just stuck up here. We've lost access.
I'm Jumpin' Jack Flash came out by the Stones. So I thought, all right, perfect, man. I'm going to drive. And I started driving through the neighborhood, and I got a text from Mick Jagger.
People saying that, you know, what we do is non-essential. Well, playing those few gigs that you saw me at felt pretty essential to me.
It wasn't like they were clapping from here. Is they were clapping from here.
My view of things is that death is the last and best reward for a life well lived.
Like you gotta, it's the strangest of places if you look at it right, you know?
If you're liking what you're hearing, head on over to patreon.com/comesatimepod and get your bus pass for an extra episode every week.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Comes a Time. That's O'Teal.
And that's Mike.
Amy Cuddy today. This is easily one of the most important things I think I've ever, like, this was unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
It's
really,
really help
powerful.
It's going to help a lot of people. She helps a lot of people. She's been through some heavy stuff and, man, I'm just so grateful to her for really opening up. She told us some stuff that she's never told anyone publicly before, and at a sizable risk, an emotional risk, you know. And this is a person that speaks publicly thousands of times, what she does for a living, you know. And wow, I don't even want to, I'm just going to say, just watch it. Everybody's going through stuff, and she has some very profound, helpful things.
Yeah, and this is this is an episode that was just iceberg after iceberg after iceberg that we could have spent hours and hours on. So we'll be having her back for sure. I genuinely can't thank her enough for her vulnerability and her time. And please, everybody, like, take a good listen and watch to this one, because it hits a bullseye right down the middle. So thank you, Amy. And, you know, Teal, thanks for inviting her on, because this was important. So
yeah,
just everybody take care of yourselves and each other, and Jesus, man, that's,
yeah, if this doesn't help you, well, it will help you, but it will definitely help someone you know.
Right.
100%.
Yeah,
please watch this podcast, please.
Thank you, Amy. And thanks for everybody that listens and supports. We love you. And we couldn't do this without you. And if you're enjoying, head over to patreon.com/comesatimepod for bonus episodes. We'll be talking about this one over there for sure. And we had a great community over there. And we're here on Osiris, home to great podcasts. You can head to osirispod.com. And again, thank you so much to Amy. And we'll see you guys soon. Be good. Be safe.
Is that Joni Mitchell in the background?
Oh, yeah. It's a
That's
Jade
a beautiful
photo.
Picture.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
She just had a birthday, didn't she? Was her birthday like 2 days ago or not long ago?
Really?
Yeah, because all my friends, well, not all of my friends, but
I feel
people
like
that
Joni
I follow.
Mitchell's like the other half of my feed is you guys and the other half of my feed is Joni Mitchell. And I somehow missed that. So,
yeah,
we're really happy to have you. Friends.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. And yeah, this sounds like so many great things to talk about.
For
Let's
sure. Dive in.
I wanted to ask you, because, you know, it must have been almost 10 years ago that Jess and I got onto your TED Talk. I think it was about power poses.
Yep, it came out 10 years ago last month.
You what?
It came out 10 years ago in October.
All right. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
congratulations.
I was on the nose pretty much. But that, you know, so we've been following you for a while and it still kind of trips both me and my wife out that like we can text you and stuff.
That's so funny because I feel the same way.
Because she's such a big deadhead, you know.
Oh, yeah.
My wife is like, you know, Amy Cuddy's a deadhead. I was like, no.
that overlap in my world is awesome because it will be so unexpected. Like I'll be giving a talk to at a totally corporate event and like, you know, five guys in suits will come up afterwards and be like, so what was your favorite show? What's your favorite song? What do you want to hear say next? And you know, they want to talk about the dead, not what I just talked about for an hour.
Of course.
So, I mean, I have like a Jerry sticker on the other side of my computer that's also always showing. So people are, you know,
you gotta throw the bat signal out there so people
can
see it.
It's a way of connecting. It's funny. You know, I was talking to a friend about this. He's like, well, why do you always wear this? I don't know if you can see.
Yeah.
And my son has one too, that we wear them together. It's funny. When I had one of my knee surgeries, because I tore both my ACLs last year and I had three knee surgeries in the last year. And as I'm going under, they're like, oh, we need to take your jewelry, you know, and they had already given me like a sedative. And I give up like my wedding ring.
You can have the wedding ring, but no.
They're like, we need this. I'm like, you can't take this. You can't take this. I need this. And they're like, we need to take it. And then when I was coming out from the surgery, I'm like very bothered, I think, by the anesthesia. And I started saying, the anesthesiologist was very terse with me. He wanted to take my Steely necklace. He was very terse. I don't know. There's one of those coming out from anesthesia. And I'm like, I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to be a joke.
Oteel, do you remember I was telling you about when I went to the dent? I had to have dental work done and I listen to music anytime I can, just because I get antsy. And I was listening to that Pacific Northwest 73-74 collection that just came out. And it was that bird song. And I stopped the dentist. I went, wait, like they're in my mouth. And I go, you guys got to hear this. Cause like the anesthesia.
This is my life. I love this.
And they're like, we can't hear. I'm like, oh, this jam is great. But meanwhile, I'm like all numb and like drooling
that
all over everything.
So good. I had an MRI once that was an hour and a half long and they're like, what do you want to listen to? And I'm like, the dead. Just an hour and a half. I was completely unfussed the whole time.
Nice. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, I really wanted to talk to you about
other things.
No.
Anesthesia and dead jams.
They're all
like
related.
A fun podcast.
Actually, it's super related because I would think I wanted to talk to you about your car accident when you were 19. Like after that, I wouldn't want to go to the doctor again for anything. Like after, although I guess it could be the opposite. You'd be like, well, after what I came through, ACLs are no big deal. But
Yeah.
What was that Well, tell me about the car accident first, and then how it was coming back from that.
You know what's funny, OTL? You don't remember this, and I don't. There's no reason why you would, but I actually met you not long after my car accident.
Really?
Yeah.
When you were 19?
I was 20. And
20, sorry.
But I remember, well, I was 19 when I had the accident, but I was 20 when I met you. I remember my hair was like this long because I had had to cut a lot of my hair off. But you were playing an aquarium rescue unit show at the Fox Theater in Boulder. And my friend Rebecca and I gave you a ride home in her pickup truck. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. What year was this? Wow.
Like, well, it would have been like, it was early 90s. So.
Wow.
I don't know what year. That whole time is vague for me, before and after. So you lose like a bit before and a bit after, usually when you have a head injury like that. But when would that have been for you? So 90.
God, 90. So this 92. Was with Colonel Bruce was still in the band?
Yes, I would say it was 92. So
it would have to be 92 or 93. I remember a girl named Rebecca.
Long red hair. She was from Alabama.
Yeah, and I lived in Alabama.
Okay, all right.
I lived in Birmingham, Alabama.
That's where she was from. Years. I think you knew some common people too.
Yeah, probably Jeep and a bunch. Wow, so we did meet then.
Yeah, and you stayed at that little motel that was like at the bottom. It's called something else now, but it was like this little motel.
Oh, it's awful. Yeah.
Right off the campus, exactly. And we drove you home in her pickup truck that had big, like, flowers with female signs on the side, painted, hand painted on the side of it.
Oh, God. Her last name just went, it's so close. It's
Rebecca Dunn was my friend.
Yeah. Rebecca Dunn. Oh, wow. That's so crazy. We met back then. That happens to me now. I'll be talking to people many, many years later. And I'll be talking about the first time I met him. And they're like, actually, I met like with Thundercat. I met him when he was 12 at a NAMM show. And I was like, oh
really?
My gosh.
I didn't. Yeah, I wouldn't. He told him, he's like, I've already met you. I was like, when? How did I miss that? He's like, well, I was 12. I was like, oh, that's how I missed it. That's cool. So we had already, it was fate had already crossed our lines.
That, yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Wow,
and this wild. Was right after the car accident, or
it was like a year after I had just come back to school. So I was, you know, I had taken a year off and had just come back to school. And interestingly, Rebecca was the friend who was driving when we had the car accident, but we remained very, very close friends. So what happened was we were driving from Missoula, Montana to Boulder overnight. We were working with this organization called the Student Environmental Action Coalition as grassroots organizers. And we were working with students at the University of Montana. We had planned a big conference in Boulder, and we were driving back and trying to get back overnight for like an 8 a.m. class. And it's like 14 hours. Like, so we left at 6, you know, at p.m. the night before.
Yeah.
We were taking shifts, and Rebecca had the last shift. We were in a Jeep Cherokee, an old one, and the seats were down in the back. So whoever, one person would be driving, one person would be keeping the other person awake in the front seat. And then the other person would be sleeping in a sleeping bag. And I was first shift driving and sleeping in the last shift. So it was like 3 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
And, know how it is. Sorry.
We can edit. No, it's fine.
So it was like 3 in the morning, and the passenger fell asleep, also a good friend, and Rebecca fell asleep and just hit the rumble strips as she was sort of veering off the road, and that woke her up. And she overcorrected. So we flipped 1.5 times.
Oh, wow.
But it was the middle of Wyoming, the middle of the night. There was nothing, no cell phones. I got thrown very far out of the car, beyond the car. Whoa. And they had their seatbelts on, thank God, and landed upside down, but uninjured. One of the passenger cut his hand, and that was it. And which is unbelievable, because she, you know, she says we were going at least 80 and probably 90, because it's Wyoming. It's like, you know, the speed limit is really high, and it was
it's 3 in the morning. Yeah.
And so I got thrown out and stayed in the sleeping bag somehow. So I got thrown out sideways And like, wow. And when you look at the car, we've looked at like the, we don't even understand how I got out because I seem to go out sideways, but the way the doors are and the back of the car was flattened because the front had roll bars and the back didn't. And so it's really good that I got thrown out, but I stayed in the sleeping bag. My head just really hit the highway, like kind of grazed the highway. Like I, so it's all like, I lost a lot of skin scalp here. And I was, it was a head injury. So I was bleeding terribly and I was completely unconscious. And, you know, I feel so much for her because she thought she had killed me, you know,
and they probably thought you were dead lying there.
She did. And she thought she had done that. You know, she was my roommate and one of my best friends. And, you know, these are wonderful people. I don't blame them at all. You know, she was always the one who had the spine to take the last shift, right? She was super tough. And it took about 20 minutes, no cell phones, until somebody drove by. And it was a trucker who called in on his radio.
Thank God he had that radio. Yeah.
I know. Wow. But they had to wait. I just think about those 20 minutes often and what that was like for her to not
and
know.
And it probably was longer than that for that. So for somebody for the, actually
for the
get
ambulance
to, you
to get there. But just Wyoming. For them to be alone, it's like out of a David Lynch movie or something.
Yeah, really. You know? That's what I, Were you unconscious the whole 20 minute? Like, were you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Man.
So, and then I was in the hospital for a long time. So I think I was in Cheyenne at first, and then they moved me to Boulder, and Boulder actually has a kind of head injury rehab unit because there are a lot of ski and climbing head injuries.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So a lot of people in that unit with me who were young people.
Yeah.
So that, and it just, I then had to, that was in February of my second year of college. I had to withdraw, obviously. I mean, I was withdrawn and my doctors said, you know, you are going to be high functioning, but you're going to have trouble finishing college. And, you probably won't finish college. And I also learned that my IQ had gone down by 30 points, which is a lot. I'm a psychologist now, and that's two standard deviations. That's a huge number. I knew my IQ because I had been in the gifted program as a kid. And it was one of those things that I felt was immutable. Like I could, other things would change about me as I grew up, but I would always be smart, even if I were messing around, like, well, following a little band called The Dead, like, no matter what, I'd be smart. And it really, really shook me to the core. And the thing about the IQ test that people don't know is that it's not so fixed. You can study for the IQ. You can get better at it. You know, there's enormous amount of bias in it. Like I remember being asked some question about it. There's some IQ question, a definition that had to do with like yachts or something. And I was like, I don't know. Like an Amish country. You know, I don't know what that thing is. Yeah. But like, that should not affect
you took the Cape Cod version of the
right, exactly. So anyway, I tried to go back to school twice. That was one of the signs I met UOTL. Like it was during one of those stints. And then on the third try, it kind of took, but I kept having to drop out. I could not process spoken information, reading. It was like looking at, you know, just, well, the way a page looked at 20 with a head injury was about the way it looks at 50 with my vision. So
it was actually physical. Like, do you mean that literally? Like it was physically blurry to see?
It just didn't, it seemed scrambled.
Wow.
Yeah. So I did eventually, it's funny because if you ever Google your name and see what people look for, well, first of all, if you're a woman and you have any level of fame, I'll tell you what the first few things will be as you, when you first have some level of fame, bikini and feet, which is so creepy. right? Then they get over that. We always joke that my husband would put a picture of his feet and like we would like put in the metadata like Amy Cuddy feet, you know? And they get over it. But are you serious?
Put the hobbit's feet in there. Put a big old hobbit.
Just but muddy socks.
Then it was, yeah, well, yeah.
Wow, like that is crazy.
Like, but then it became like Amy Cuddy IQ or Amy Cuddy, you know, IQ today. Like, oh, why? Anyway, but the truth is I needed to know too. And I did a few years later retake it and it was almost up to where it had been before. So I did recover and you know, I was 19. There's a lot of brain plasticity that was serving me and, yeah. And I was working hard. But I didn't graduate from college until 98, and I would have graduated in 94. I graduated from high school in 90. So it took me 4 extra years to finish school.
Well, you go ahead, Mike.
No, I wanted to ask about like that when you said you were working on it and, were, you know, like if you sustain an injury, obviously there's atrophy to the muscles and the area and you could actually, you know, see and feel a difference. And you have to do that rehabilitation and recovery. What was that like? Were you able to, like, did you have a regimen of, like, trying to focus harder? I'm just trying to visualize at 19 or 20, like, looking at a piece of paper and it being so blurry. Like, what a frustration.
It was so frustrating.
And what a cause of anxiety that must have been.
Oh, God. I always tend toward anxiety, right? So that just made that so much worse.
Right.
I tried, like I did a lot of reading about learning, but I really feel, you know, I listened to Mozart a lot. There was the whole Mozart makes you smarter. And then there was the no, it doesn't. And then the actually no, there is something about the rhythm that does facilitate learning. I really had to relearn to learn. And that was strange because I never thought about learning how I learned. It just worked. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And now I had to think about it. I took notes very neatly and cleanly by hand. Like I realized that writing, physically writing, the act of writing really helped me remember things. Like the notes from college, my notebooks are, I saved because people would be like, you don't have to write everything down. You can just, you know, get like I do. I have to write everything down, things like that. But the big part of it, it's not just the cognition, it was the emotion. My friends would tell me, my high school friends, who I'm still so, I have such great high school and college friends. And it's all, honestly, we all are linked around music. You know, it was our love of music. And you know, that brings people together in a different way. But some of them would say, you're not the same person. And that's, oh, God.
Yeah, that's painful.
Because I'd say, well, how? How? Because I didn't even know what they meant. And so I felt like I had to break up with this former version of myself before knowing if there was another version of myself out there. So it's sort of like when you're in a not great relationship, but it's not terrible. And you know, you got to break up, but you really have no idea if there's a better match for you out there. I was like breaking up with that old self before I knew if there was another self. I still think at the core, I am very much, there's a kernel in there. There's like a, that is just absolutely Amy and it's never going anywhere. But, you know, I understand I probably reacted differently emotionally to things. At that age, your friends are kind of scared when you're having a trauma response to something. So a lot of it, I think, was also just they're not knowing how to handle my anxiety, my confusion.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a lot. And then when you're already kind of geared towards anxiety, and then it's an interesting thing. I think about it quite a bit where it's like, you know, sometimes anxiety is a cloud that's a distance away and you go, I see it. I acknowledge it and I know to kind of stay away from there or put a raincoat on. And sometimes it's just a fog that engulfs you. And then you're like, we're in it now and got to try to weather the storm and find my way out. And that's a hard place to be. And it lasts a long time sometimes, like years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And if people don't get it, then they don't, it's hard to explain that.
It really is. And you know, I'm writing this book on bullying now, on adult bullying and bravery and bystander behavior. And people who haven't been through being bullied, you know, or experiencing trauma, that kind of relational trauma, they really don't get it. And it's that empathy gap is tough.
Yeah.
It's, and you lose friendships over those things. You know, if people really can't understand the reality of your experience, and I don't like the my truth thing. It's not my truth. It's just it's the truth.
Right.
It's what happened, and it's how it feels. And yeah, that empathy gap is, it makes me really sad, because I know psychological struggle. Like I know it personally, not just because I'm a psychologist. I know it. And I am not standing in judgment of people who are struggling. Like people who are like, why can't they just do this? The why can't they just, anything that starts with the why can't they just, it's like, stop there.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
That's an excellent point. Right.
You need more information about a person to understand why they can't just.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, if anyone ever actually said, like, why can't you be calmer? Why can't you be more trusting? Why can't it be like, do you think I choose to think that the floor is going to fall out from under me at any moment? Do you think that don't want it? Like, I would love to trust. I would love to have no fear. I mean, that's amazing if that was the case. So it's funny when people go, why can't you just, or I always love the people that go, just relax.
Oh,
and it's like, why didn't I think of that?
This is absolutely, well, it's funny because, you know, there was the whole keep calm phase, right? That meet like 7 years ago, I feel like everything was keep calm and blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
And as a psychologist, I can tell you that absolutely backfires. And one of my favorite studies in psychology looked exactly at, you know, how does that apply to stage fright? So it was actually done by a colleague of mine at Harvard Business School named Allison Wood Brooks, who had been a wedding singer before grad school.
Wow.
And she has no stage fright. She is just like, put me up on stage and I'm great. And so she really had that empathy gap. She was like, why are all my students afraid to speak? Or why are they? And so she started studying it, and she had that say, why can't they just do this? Why can't they just keep calm? And she realized that the problem is that, so I got to set my Althea cup here down.
Nice.
Because I have to use my hands to describe this. All right. So emotion at a sort of simple level, people think of it as, you know, on this continuum from negative to positive. But there's another dimension that really matters, and that's arousal level. So some emotions are very low arousal, like depression and calm. Yeah. And some are very high arousal, like anxiety and excitement. And the thing is, it's very hard to change the arousal level, because it's your nervous system telling you something is going on, something that you need to be vigilant about, whether it's good or bad. The positive negative part is easier to change cognitively. You can say, maybe I'm, and so what Allison studied was whether you could change anxiety to excitement. And so she had people say, before they went, she did this sort of, what was the, like the video game where you'd sing, I can't, Rock Band.
Karaoke.
But like that's where you'd get points for singing well or not, or playing guitar.
Oh, it's escaping. I know what you're talking about. I can't think of it right now.
It has a little guitar, toy guitar thing.
Yeah. Anyway, so she had them do sing as a sort of competition, but they were randomly assigned to one of three conditions. In one, they said, I am excited. In one, they said, I am anxious. And in another one, they said, I'm calm. And the ones that performed the best were the ones who said, I am excited. So basically they reframed their anxiety as excitement. Calm did not help them. When you say I'm calm and you're not calm, all it does is makes you meta aware that you're not calm, and it makes you more anxious, right? So then you're like, shit, I am definitely not calm. Oh my God, it must be really bad, right? But if you say, wait, maybe I'm excited. maybe this isn't anxiety. Maybe I'm excited to go on stage. That's what works. And that study, she did that in singing competitions, in debate competitions, before math exams, all kinds of stuff. This is one of my son's favorite tricks now.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I love that.
So that's my best stage fright advice. Well, actually, I have two. Sorry, I'm all over the place.
Please keep going. Okay, yeah.
One is that, the other is, because people say, how do you, because I love speaking and I don't get nervous. It could be, 50,000 people and it doesn't rattle me. I love it. And the other one though, because it's something that I had to learn, was to trust that people want you to do well.
Yeah.
When you go out there, they're not there wanting to see you fail. Even if a couple are, the vast majority are there to learn, to be moved. And, they want to experience that joy with you. They want to have that ecstatic collective experience. And so I trust the audience. I trust that they want me to do well. And when you give them trust, you get it right back. And it creates a kind of magic, I think. And certainly, I mean, absolutely the same for music. And that for my son, Jonah, it's funny, in the beginning of his first year, and he's a good guitar player. He is so modest. He'd be like, Mom, don't say that. He's really good. But he said to me, he's like, I think I have paralyzing stage fright. This was his first year at Berklee College of Music. I'm like, oh shit, this is going to be a problem. But then I told him my two tricks. Like a week later, he's like, I'm good. I'm fine.
So wow, that fast.
It was also like getting out there and doing it and realizing that people do want you to do well.
I've been doing it since I was five, and it hasn't gone away one bit.
But
I'm going to try this.
When you're on, I shouldn't say he still feels very anxious before walking on, but once he's there, he's fine. And before, he felt that really tensed up when he would go on stage. Yeah. Like, why couldn't I rip that solo the way I did when I was practicing? And now he feels much more relaxed.
About two songs in.
Yeah, that makes sense too.
Like, right? I always know I don't need a clock. Like, my stomach just knots up a couple hours before I have to go on. It sucks, man.
I've noticed too, it's like the hardest way to go on stage is from silence. So if you're standing on the side of the stage and you're not conversing with anybody or talking with anybody, and then your name gets called and you have to go out there, that to me is the worst case scenario. But if I can like be chatting with a stagehand or a buddy or anybody right off stage and then go out, I feel like a whole different energy. I'm like coming out of a conversation and I'm like, let's do it. And that feels great.
I love that. And that's funny, because that's another one I've been thinking about that hasn't been tested, but I try to arrive early. If I'm giving a talk to a big audience, and the people who get there early are the ones who really want to see you. And so I meet them, I go introduce myself to them and I chat with them. And so then when I'm speaking, I can be looking at them and they're like, so with you then, they're nodding along. And I noticed that, in this last tour, you were doing a lot of Instagram lives.
Oh yeah.
Or shows. And I was like, that's the same kind of thing in a way, because I was actually physically at most of the shows, but a lot of people are watching them and you're connecting with your fans. Like, you're connecting with them before you go out, and they are loving that. And so I'm wondering, does that help at all?
Not at all. It's funny. But my thing is, it's a mental. Sorry for all my sneezing and coughing.
No, please.
Spitting. My thing is that I know I have had some really good nights, and those are the nights that become legendary or whatever. Like, O'Teal is that great, but I'm not that great every night, and so sometimes I feel way less of whatever, it's all in here. So it's like, I'm always going to be judged at this height, and maybe it's going to be here tonight. And I feel bad about that in advance of the disappointment, which is just like, it's all a lie. And I know, like now a lot of times I'll just sit and I can't call it meditating because I only get about 5 or 10 minutes. But I'll be on stage and I'll just block everything out because the energy of 20 to 40,000 people, just I can't not feel it.
Of course.
The same reason I can't be in New York longer. I hate to be in New York any longer than a week.
Oh, yeah.
I need to get out. It's just too much energy. And I know they're all pulling for me and I know all of that. And then my little critic goes, yeah, but you don't feel like the best night tonight, do you? You know, I love this thing about what you're that you can trick yourself.
Yeah.
It's almost like the power poses too. I can say, I'm not anxious. I'm excited.
That's exactly right.
I'm really intrigued to try that because I know you can trick yourself, but I haven't tried that one yet.
That's what, and it's things, the whole, it's by the way, what you were just describing, I would call borrowing trouble from the future.
Yes. It's like that. Our favorite quote, expectations are premeditated resentments.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. But both the expansive posture, you know, tricking your nervous system into feeling that you actually are in control, that you're safe, is very similar to telling yourself, actually, this is excitement and not anxiety. It's the same in a way. It's very likely the same nervous system mechanism. And that's why self-talk in the old fashioned, like I don't know if you remember the old Stuart Smalley sketches.
Oh, I love enough. I'm smart enough. I'm smart enough
and doggone it, people like me.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. But then he'd be like, and now I'm in a shame spiral. Like by the end. And everyone hates me and I'll never be loved. And, you know, I love that sketch.
Oh, me too,
it
man.
It captures exactly why self-talk doesn't work. So the classic, I'm great. I'm actually great. You're like, no, I'm not. I feel terrible.
Exactly.
I felt like that was one of the most genius SNL sketches. Yeah, for sure. And as a psychologist, I'm like, exactly that. That's why you know that doesn't work. Now, if you are doing well and feeling, if you're in a good state of mind, so like if you're, you know, Michaela Schifrin and you're about to ski and you're like having an on day saying, I'm awesome, that works. But if you feel terrible and you say, I'm awesome, you're like, I'm not awesome. And now you're fighting with yourself. You're like, you're a liar too. You're also a liar. Not only are you not awesome, you're a liar. You know? So you've broken trust with yourself.
It's so funny the way that we kind of like the survival comes into play where if you don't have the tricks, you almost kind of like conjure them up. You know, like I remember for a while, if I had anxiety, I would have literally double anxiety because my first anxiety was there. And then my second one was like, can everyone tell I'm anxious? So it was like,
oh, exactly.
I'm anxious about being anxious because I don't know. So what I decided to try was just to say out loud, literally, like I'm feeling anxious right now. And it cut the anxiety in half.
That definitely helps.
Because then it's like, I said it.
I'm owning it. I'm accepting the reality of this moment.
Right. Literally, it's like, it's like either pass out or say it. And
run. I was giving a talk once at the University of Chicago, which is, I don't know if you know, like the unofficial slogan of the University of Chicago is where fun goes to die. And they're proud of that. Right. Wow. And I was at the time a professor at Northwestern, which is also a great school in Chicago, but like Northwestern's known as this friendly place. And everyone had warned me that the Chicago audience is terrible. Like they're so mean. And it was like worse even than I thought. And there was a guy in the front who had a monocle and he would like go be like, can you go back a slide? And he'd look at it and he'd go, and then he'd start laughing. Oh, and I was like, I'm going to die. You know, and academic talks are 90 minutes, minutes, right? And so an hour in, I remember like my mouth had gone completely dry, like I'm sweating bullets, and I was holding onto the lectern. And I looked up at the clock and I thought, I'm gonna go. I'm just gonna leave. I'm gonna run out. All this went through my mind. I'm like, my career is gonna be over for sure. I don't care. It's worth it. And I like just about did it. And then another guy in the audience sort of like gave me a reassuring expression, and I got through it. It was not good, but I got through it, and I'm so glad I didn't run. But I definitely had the absolute, you know, can't faint. Yeah. I am now frozen. So it's fight, flee, or freeze. Fight, flee, or freeze. I can't fight. I can't.
Yeah.
What do I do? I guess I did fight it out in a way. I got through it.
In a way. And I think those are good for us in retrospect. It's like I realized when I watch young people have a job that they just hate, and I switch from feeling bad for them to remembering when I had that job, and that was the job that let me know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I had to be a musician. Mm-hmm. I was like, whatever, however bad it is being a musician, it can't be this bad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so some of those times were like when we had Amy Helm on, she was at this crossroads moment where her dad, Levon, like put her on the spot and said, look, you know, you should be a musician. Like, I'm just going to shove you out of the nest here and you start flapping. And I think she said she went to Memphis, was it, Mike?
I believe so. Yeah. I think that's when she went there. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so they're doing this show in Memphis. So all these Memphis legends come out because of Levon. And she's up there, and now she's like used to doing her thing, you know, but something happened. I think it was a mystical thing that was a blessing to her in hindsight, where she got like a quarter, like a half step off key or something and couldn't get back in. And she's with like all these great singers like on stage or in the audience. And it was just like totally ego crushing.
Oh, you know, and what happened?
Just like, well, it was like my one of my biggest mentors, Colonel Bruce, used to say, when it wasn't often, but some nights, you know, where you can't do anything right. It's just everything.
Yeah.
It's just the worst. Or you're playing great and the crowd is just like, they're not feeling it. And he goes, well, I'm glad that happened. I'm like, you're glad? He goes, what are the odds of that happening again tomorrow?
Or that's even
for the next 6 months.
Get it out of
like,
the way.
You have to have those. True. It's the you know, you can't inhale all the time. The sun can't be out all the time. It has to go down. So when you have that really bad thing, and then, okay, like the next day, you're like, well, I'm still alive.
Yeah.
You're going to your next show. That's probably not going to happen that same way again. Mm. So
that's true.
Either way, it's like, if it's just the odds or if it teaches you like, okay, I got through that.
Hey there, Osiris listeners. I wanted to tell you about our friends over at Smart Wool. For more than 25 years, Smart Wool has been making merino wool socks and apparel designed to keep you comfortable. Because they want to help you play, laugh, and explore in the outdoors with every thread they knit and every step you take. Because they believe that comfort sharpens focus and lets you perform beyond your limits. They are here to help you feel good. Now it's up to you how far you will go. Take 15% off of your first order at smartwool.com. Smart Wool. Go far, feel good.
That's so true. And also know that if that's happening, I'm in the pit taking names.
That moment you describe, Amy, is like such a, like, if for people who haven't, I'm getting like shaky and like just listening to the moment, because I know that moment.
I feel a little anxious
and
too.
You have no, like, people don't understand that each second, like, you're telling this story and you're explaining that in your head you're going, well, my career's over, I should just run. Hold on to the thing and don't pass out. Meanwhile, you're presenting. All of this is going on behind, you know, and like in Born Standing Up, Steve Martin in the acknowledge in the intro talks about it perfectly, how a stand-up comic is delivering one joke, thinking about how the last one went, and thinking about what the next one's going to be, all exactly. while trying to. So it's like they called it the ego's last stand. So basically, like, to be in that moment and you're outwardly giving a presentation and inside you're going, well, I can always start a, you know, a bakery or a landscaping company when this ends. You know what I mean? Like, you're kind of like, it's over. That moment of like, you're in the most present, but it's also so terrifying.
It is. And it can be, you know, it's funny, in the beginning of my book, I talk about, I mean, my last book, not the one I'm working on now, I do tell a story about being at a conference as a grad student, and it's my last year and I'm supposed to have an elevator pitch. And I literally get into an elevator with these three guys in my field who are like giants. And and my tag just says like graduate student, you know, and they don't even need tags. And I get in, and one of them goes, "We're in an elevator. Give us your pitch." And it was like, I think, whoa. I said, "I study," and everything else after that was just gone. Like, it was a disaster. Wow. And I'm going in this elevator ride, which, it's funny, I remember as going to the 20th floor, and my friend Elizabeth said it was the fourth floor, but I thought my whole life had flashed. I was going, it's okay. I'm going to move to Vermont. I'll be an organic farmer. It's fine. I always want to do that. I don't have to be a professor. And I get to the top, and two of the guys, as the elevator doors open, they flee so fast. They're like, oh, I mean, they knew it was bad. The one who had goaded me to give the pitch goes, he steps out of the elevator. I'm still in. That's how like shut down I was. And he goes, as the doors are closing, he goes, "That was the worst elevator pitch I've ever heard." Door closes. I mean, wow. It truly is worst case scenario. But the thing is, guess what? I'm made still it. Here.
That's right. Right.
I survived. I was not able to be present at that conference in my mind because I wanted a kind of rom-com style do-over, you know, where you like get in the elevator again and do it great the second time, but you don't really get those. You know?
Now you like, you run them down, you're in a cab with them, and you're like, just one more time, just one more time.
Exactly. And they're like, nailed it. Didn't nail it.
Can I?
But it's like making mistakes on the bandstand. We go, well, when we're learning a new song, right, and we go over it in rehearsal, you hope you go over it until you get it all right one time at least in rehearsal, and then you go right. on, and inevitably you mess up at this one spot, someone messes up at another spot, and I always am like, that's fine, because if I make a mistake the next time, it won't be in that spot,
right?
You know what I mean? So you kind of, yeah, like exactly, your errors exactly. are good, because then you error correct, you know. Mm.
That's good.
And also, you know, I remember Patrice O'Neill had a saying that was said, killing is easy, meaning that like, if you're always doing phenomenal, then you're doing something wrong, because yeah. then it's like, you're kind of maybe on autopilot and you're not trying new stuff and you're not going right. back into the, if you're just staying in the shallow end, cause you know, a bit yeah. works. So,
I'm sorry.
No, that's go ahead. Yeah. So I think about that. Like, you have to make that's errors right. to well, learn.
Because I think there's also something that goes beyond that. And it's that people actually want you to be human and real.
Yes.
They want an authentic connection. And so people like mistakes. They like, so if you, I've got to tell you that there was I don't know if you remember, Gillette, 2019, Box of Rain. You guys restarted because I think John forgot the lyrics or something. Like, we were up front.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. Actually, I think the teleprompter went
out. Right. So there was something up. But it was, his face was so apologetic. I happened to miraculously be in the front row, which truly is a miracle.
Yeah.
Anyway. And we could really see him. I was with Jonah too, who, by the way, our dog is named Mayor.
How cool.
So we're watching his face, and he just looked crushed, and he mouthed like, "I'm sorry," or something like that. And people, I mean, our hearts were swelling for all of you. Like it doesn't, nobody was like, "Oh, what a letdown." People were like, "We love you guys so much more now. We
got
to see a human moment of mistake, because we're not seeing the mistakes that you're seeing." But when we do see one, it makes you feel so human. And we're like family. We love you even more. And so the people want an experience that's never happened before and that will never happen again. So people love to be like, I was at that show with pride. Like, what an awesome show. Remember
Deadheads are the only ones like that.
They're not.
As far as music, you know, I know people in general like that to, and I guess other styles of music, it's true, but I it's definitely more pronounced with Deadheads because, like, you know, if Jerry or somebody or Bob or whatever, it just like the crowd cheers. They're like, ah,
yeah, I know.
And you're like, okay, that's not the reaction I was expecting.
It's cool because they owned it. They owned it the whole time too. Like any interview with them, they go like, tell me about Woodstock, and Jerry and them would laugh and go, we always blow it at the big ones. We always, it's just so neat to like, they're misfit power, you know, and all that. And they earn it and own it. And that's kind of freeing to watch the people you love so much.
To own it for
be
sure.
Be okay with mistakes.
Okay with mistakes. But I think you were actually playing shows, so you don't get, it's funny. I'm noticing already with my son, he plays more now than he gets to go see, but I get to see a ton of shows. So I get to see a lot of other musicians too. And I can tell you that I think it's a universal experience. I'm glad
to hear that.
Here's one other one, Ray LaMontagne. This was like,
love him.
Love him too. Like seven, 8 years ago, he is famously so shy. So private and shy, and doesn't talk much at all on stage in a different way. Not in the same way that the dead, you know, that you guys don't talk on stage. This is like he's too afraid to talk. But he had started a song and he had just gotten this horrible, I think, Rolling Stone review. And it was really bugging him. And he started the song and he stopped and he goes, you know what? And sorry, you might have to bleep this out.
No, it's okay.
He goes, fuck Rolling Stone. People were like, what's going on? But then he was just like, fuck those guys. And then he started again. And it was like, he had this ghost, you know, and he just had to say, I got to get rid of this. Like, this is haunting me, the show. And people loved that they got to see that moment. They loved it. They loved the restart of the song. And I'm sorry, I feel bad saying that because he's like such a nice guy.
No,
and Rolling Stone's complicated, complicated place in my heart, but I get it.
To get that monkey off his back.
Exactly.
I guess I come from playing jazz or, you know, and classical, even in the early days where, you know, mistakes are like, you're full of it. You're not ready yet. Go away. Come back when you're ready. You know, it's like a super harsh judgment.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and which is funny because in improvised music, you're also challenged to go out to where you can make mistakes. Like, you know, so a lot of it, you have to balance. It's like, how much of this is in my head? How much am I projecting onto them thinking I suck?
Yeah.
Or if I make a mistake, you know. Although I have gotten it legitimately sometimes, but with the dead, you know, it was so cool because like coming out of the acid tests, they were like, you know, we weren't obligated to perform well at all, or even perform. Like if we were tripping too hard, we could just stop.
Right. Yeah. It was different. The goal was different.
The philosophy from the get go was different. And that's such a beautiful thing, and a lot of the musics that I gravitated towards after my initial musical upbringing were like that. It was like, throw yourself off the cliff, and you know, if you splat, it's fine.
Yeah,
let's see if you splatted a different way this time than you splatted the last time. Like, it's all good, and I like that. I still want to do well, but you know. Which brings us to psychedelics, because I remember talking to Kreutzmann when I first had the trio with him and Murawski. I've told this story a few times on the podcast, but he used to do a little bit of acid every night. And at his age, I was like, dude, like every night, finally, I just had to ask him, like, every night? And he's like, well, it's just a little. It's microdose. I said, but every night? I said, why? He goes, because it removes judgment. So it's like, I think that is it's a convenient way for people to break that cycle. but I really want to get there without it.
Yeah.
You know what? I want to remove the judgment without it. I want to trick myself however kind of way, you know?
It's funny that you said that because, sorry, going dark, serious, whatever now. And by the way, I don't know how long you guys have.
It's up to you, mama.
Keep going. My general schedule for life is how long is a dead show? I've got that long. So anyway,
is a dark star? That's what we'll do.
But it is in those units. It's like at least a full second set. Come on. I have definitely experienced a lot of trauma, and this is something that I have not talked about publicly yet. And my heart is racing
Well, we appreciate you letting it out here.
I'm writing this book, right, on bullying. That's a combination of memoir and psychology. Like what is happening? Like why do people do this? What's the anatomy of this? And why do bystanders do nothing? Why do they climb on the bandwagon? Why is it that people take pleasure in others' pain? You know, how can we be courageous socially? You know, I call it social bravery, but. And during my long period of being bullied by academics in my field, and which isn't totally over, but I'm definitely beyond the worst part of it.
Yeah.
I twice was in psychiatric wards because that's where, both of those shouldn't probably have happened the way they did. There were other places I could have been. And one experience was much worse than the other. But something, you know, I did not want to live. I just wanted to go to sleep and not wake up. You know, that's where I was with it. And I was utterly demoralized. And I now know that that's the experience of being so badly bullied by people you once trusted.
Yeah.
It demoralization captures, it is the breaking of a person's mind, heart, and spirit. It's stealing their hope, and putting them into a state of just confusion and incredulity. You're like, how is this happening? Where are the grownups? You know, and also I've been drained of everything. There's nothing left in me. There's nothing left. I remember the first time they put me into this lockdown kind of ward that I wasn't expecting to go to. And I sat there and I was in the hallway and it was like sometime between midnight and the witching hour. You know, I don't even know. And the orderly took my suitcase and I didn't even care. I couldn't move. My hands were like lead weights in my lap. I didn't care. And he came back but in the meantime, I remember tears I wasn't crying or wailing or sobbing, but I noticed these gigantic tears just like falling down my face, hitting the ground. I could hear them. And I thought, how is my body that's empty even making these tears? And I had no will to even swipe them. That was total, utter demoralization. And then he came back and I said, what were you doing? And he said, I was looking for sharps. You can't have sharps in here. And I was like, I had never heard the word sharp used as a noun. I said, what's a sharp? He's like, you know, something that you could use to hurt yourself, like a nail file or a mirror or, you know, or like the drawstring from your sweatpants or something like that, or dental floss. And I remember thinking like, sharps. I'm like, that's what I'm trying to get away from. Sharp tongues, sharp tweets, sharp sentiment. You know, I just want dolls. I don't want any sharps. You know, make the sharps, confiscate all the sharps. Interestingly, the thing about having your dental floss taken away is that you quickly learn how to floss your hair with your teeth with hair. Like you up and anyway, there's the silver lining.
Yes, but, thank you.
I'm getting to the point to where you were a minute ago, or at 10 minutes ago. The way that psychiatric care works in these situations is not all they're trying to do is keep you alive. That's all they care about. But once you're in there, you are not human. They don't see you as human. It's like a kid's book where the animals can hear each other across species. So the patients, we hear each other. Doesn't matter if you're in here for this or this or this, we hear each other and we hear the staff, but the staff can't hear us. Like, we're just speaking gibberish to them. Like, that's how they hear us, but we hear the words. So we see each other as human, and you exchange glances of sadness or empathy or, not encouragement, just understanding, but
the survival.
But the staff don't see you. So at the very moment when you've been the most dehumanized, you're now further dehumanized.
Yes. Yes.
And all they want to do is sedate you, really.
Yeah.
You know, like Ativan is like their fairy dust, right? They just want to sedate you. And that's not what you need. You know, so I guess a couple of things. One is we absolutely need to find alternative ways that are still evidence-based. I'm so for science.
Yes.
And it makes me sad that people are afraid of these possible other solutions that aren't dehumanizing and that give people back a sense of agency and power and control over their lives, because that's what I need. I need still to reinterpret what happened and make the story mine, not someone else's. And that is what some psychedelics can do, I think, especially with microdosing. But it's funny, my therapist said to me yesterday, we were talking about these two hospitalizations, and I can't believe I'm saying all this because I have not talked about this, but I think I'm okay with this given the audience. But she said, Amy, and by the way, this is not one that has ever been a drug that I've liked, but I understand what she was saying. She's like, the weird thing about it is that, you know, I've seen other patients hospitalized, but there was something always in you that never, it was always there. Like it was like a lead weight or like, you know, something, there's this kernel in you that never moves. And even if you're going like this, like it's like the balloon is going like this, you're tied to this lead weight that gets you through these things. And I always would end up having my own sort of makeshift therapy sessions with other patients. Like in the second time, which was in a much harsher, like urine stained, horrific.
Oh God.
I mean, like it really was like prison. And they said, if you don't commit yourself, they were holding me down saying, we're going to inject you. I knew my rights. I was like, Whoa. Didn't like that. It's all tumbling out. But basically they were like, we just want you to go talk to someone at this ER. And then they're like, could you, you know, I explained, I was just having a bad day. And the triage nurse said, everyone has a bad day. And then she's like, could you just come with me over here just to talk to it? And I thought, okay, well, this is like an ER, just like when I cut my finger cutting a bagel, like the triage nurse takes you to the next person. And she said, you just need to go in there. And I knew that I was walking into a lockdown and I had begged them not to. I don't know why I stepped across the border. I thought if I didn't, they'd think I was crazy. So I did. And I turned around, I looked at their faces and bam, the doors closed. And it was absolute chaos. I mean, I was begging an orderly. I tried to text my husband, an orderly grabbed me by the wrist, literally took me to my knees, got the phone out of my hand. I had a bruise on my wrist. It was every time I said, I'm allowed to talk to someone. I was invisible. But by the third day, you know, I'm in, I'm in this common room with all these other people. It was not a good situation, but like I was having my blood pressure taken at one point in the hall, and this woman next to me just spat on my foot, and like no one did anything. It was like, whatever. But I'm in this common room at the common table, like where we're like allowed to have snacks and watch TV, and all the furniture is like plastic and bolted to the, and I just started talking to people and looking in their eyes and showing that I cared. You know, I wasn't asking for private information. I was just connecting with these people around this long table. And then one of the therapists came in. I guess that some of them were supposed to go to a group session. And they started going, "We want group with Amy. We want group with Amy." And I'm like, "I'm not a clinical psychologist." And they did not like that. Like, you know, the staff didn't like that. But anyway, my therapist said, "The funny thing about you, Amy, is that no matter what, you're almost like you're like MDMA embodied. Like there's some part of you that wants to connect with people and keep you alive. And keeps you going, you know, even if it's that you want to fight for them, because then I'm like, well, I'm okay, but who's going to help these people? Yes. I've got an advocate. They've got no one outside. And that's what would keep me going.
Well, connection, you hit the nail on the head, because I think connection is sanity. You know, my worst of my addiction, what do? If we isolate, we cut off all connection.
Yes.
Right. And our, we had Stanley Krippner on, and watching his interviews and talking to him and reading his books, I realized, this is the problem with psychology and psychiatry. It's all about behavior modification. Mm-hmm. It's not about fixing the problem. Yeah. And connection fixes the problem.
Yes.
So, you know, everybody knows, Mike, you've talked about it many times on the podcast, you know, like or with me, that about a therapist that doesn't care, they're just sitting there writing on their notepad, and you know, it's like, do you even care, do you give a shit? Like,
that's the dehumanizing part.
Yeah, and it's like that connection part is everything, and if you can do that, that solves a problem. Not like, oh, this kid's got ADHD, give him pills so he just sits in his cubicle and shut up. And but, you know, it's like, how about maybe this kid's different, like connect with the kid. Maybe he doesn't have a problem.
Right.
Maybe the kid's wired differently.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, the person that bullied you is the one with the problem. And now they're grabbing your wrist.
Right.
And taking you down, like you're the one that's messed up. It's like, wait a minute.
I'm hopeful that clinical models are moving away from like things like addiction being just, you know, the disease model toward you know, their experiences of lack of connection or failed or broken or abused connection in people's lives. And that's like, can we please go to the root of these things rather than using the same, you know, template for everyone? That it is almost always about lack of being seen,
or
lack of feeling safe. Right. So for kids, I mean, it's demoralization. It's like, well, what else is there? I need to.
But what's the word I'm looking for? In a discipline that doesn't acknowledge spirit, that doesn't acknowledge, well, let's just say spirit.
Yeah.
Because I always find there's a connection between spirit and morals. Like even the word demoralization.
I know.
Like, what does morality mean to a scientist? Mm. It doesn't even exist.
Well, it is studied, right? But in a sort of, they like the word ethics more than morals.
But how can you prove scientifically that something is ethically good or bad?
And morality, it gets into.
I know it's a lot. It's a huge
there's so
can
many
of
layers
words
that I want to get into, like virtue signaling, things like this, right? But back to the spirit piece. there is something missing from the conversations. And yeah. And it is to, I do like the word spirit now very much. I say heart, but it's not just heart. It's spirit. It's the spirit, the broken spirit.
You see it with children.
Oh, yeah.
Easily. You can tell their spirit is broke. So all hope is gone. All hope is gone.
Yep.
But hope is another thing. How do you define that? How do you quantify that scientifically? Can you say? Because they're really, you know, the opposite. Like, I appreciate people like Dick Cheney that will say, yeah, I would do it all again.
Yeah.
Because his worldview is that if I win, I win. And it's better for me and sorry for you. You know, like, what does the lamb, what does the wolf care about what the lamb thinks, you know? But, and my thing is the opposite. Like, it's just like, I wouldn't want you to do that to me. So I'm going to try not to do it to, you know,
of course,
but that's a spirit thing.
Right.
And if we can't acknowledge that that even exists, then how do we fix the problem? Because the way they're trying to fix it is not fixing it.
No, and
it's not fixing it.
Even connection isn't the right kind of connection often. It's not just, you know, connection with a teacher who's trained to say these things to you.
Like, exactly.
Kids aren't idiots, right? Kids can, spirit is something that you, I think the feeling of spirit is something that you get from a very early age. You don't need to even have language yet. You feel it.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly. So it's put in us.
Exactly. And if a teacher is saying the right words, a child still knows if the real connection, the spirit is not there.
Right? A child can tell you don't even believe what you're telling me.
That's exactly
you,
right.
You have a spirit of being full of shit.
Yeah, exactly.
My exactly. kids call me all the time,
oh,
dude.
Yeah.
They, oh man.
Yeah, so does Jonah. I mean, he's 20 now. He doesn't have to call. But yeah, but yes, he was. It's funny. People joke that even by like the time he was 6 months old, he has this expression that was like, "I don't buy this." You know? Like, we always joke that our friends, by the time Jonah was 6 months old, wanted his approval more than ours. He had this way of looking at you like, "Nah."
Yeah, the filter.
He's the truth meter. You know, your story that you tell reminds me of one of our heroes, Ken Kesey, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's something.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But I do want to. I know we've been on for a long time, but I want to ask you one more question about bullying. There's a lot of things I wanted to get to that we didn't get to get to, like roller skating. We'll have to have you back on.
I'm really disappointed because I did bring. Not only these, but like all of my wheels. I had like 16 sets of wheels in here. Nice. So please, all the time, I just wait and say, wait, this is Xanadu. This is really cool because it's a skate boutique in Santa Barbara run by a woman named Val, who's a deadhead. It's a deadhead skate boutique.
Oh,
that's incredible.
We got to get her.
Awesome.
Open
she
one here
so in Boca. Nice. And she has a whole crew of people who skate together who are like deadheads. So
they just closed the only skating rink here in Boca. I'm like, who closes a skate rink? But one of the things I wanted to ask you about before we let you go is about the bullying thing.
Yeah.
I have, and this is just personal for me, like I could ask you this on the phone, but I think it would help for our audience to hear it too. I really related to when Jerry Garcia said, our band is pathologically anti-authoritarian. And I was like, that's why I ended up here. I get, okay.
Yes.
Circle closed. Now I have a child. Now I have to be authoritarian. The exact thing I would say almost the number one thing in my life that I've fought against is that authoritarian vibe.
Yeah.
But I have to do it to keep him alive. Or, for instance, like this morning, to keep him healthy. He loves video games. I let him play a little bit, but I know I have to get him outside.
Yeah.
And so it has to be a war, like unplugging from that is hard. And I've talked to child psychologists who'd be like, it's okay. You have to, it's going to be a little bit of a conflict. But then when I get him outside, he loves it. So I wanted him to ride his bike today. And I was like, but I feel like I'm bullying him.
No, I'm like,
now you're being a bully. So,
no,
okay, well, change your tone of voice. And I got down on one knee and I said, Nigel, I tried to explain to him, like, I want you, you have to be outside a certain amount. You can't just like do what you want all the time. We have to have balance and all this. And then, but he goes, well, you can't force me. And I go, I actually can force you, and I am forcing you. You'll thank me later. You know, I do all that shit that you'll be grateful later, but it still feels like bullying at the time.
It's not, you know? It's not bullying. Bullying is nothing like this. And this is, I'm glad you raised this, because I, one of the things I want to do in this book is differentiate bullying from other things that people sometimes conflate it with. But bullying is all about the intention behind it. Right. Okay. Bullying, first of all, bullying always involves more than one person. A lone bully is impotent. They can't do anything. They need people, right? A lone bully is just an asshole, right?
That's true.
So, even if he's like way, 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 way bigger than you physically,
if no one else is on board, yeah. And you're not, no, bullying is about siphoning off status from somebody else. It's about acquiring more status by destroying someone else. So the bully gets more status and the other person has to be disappeared in some way, whether they are pushed out of their field or out of the school, or they literally die. You know, that bully is someone who is unfairly trying to get status by destroying someone else. And both of those things have to happen. So think about, it's funny because this word authority, I've been thinking about a lot lately, because my motto for writing this book, which again is really hard for me, this one has taken 4 years, that one took 18 months, is from the heart with authority. Yeah. I'm writing this book from the heart with authority. And what I mean by that is I am the author authority. I'm the author of my story. Yep. And it's coming from the heart.
Yes.
And what I'm sharing with the science that I'm sharing, I have a PhD in this stuff. Like I'm allowed to feel like an authority on this topic. Yeah. I am an authority. I've studied it more than anyone else has. Right. So, but both things are from the heart and with authority. You are parenting from the heart with authority.
Okay. Thank you, because he'll say, he'll accuse me of bullying.
Yeah, just be like,
and then I just close
from the heart with authority.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, because that is what happened to you. Someone else trying to
gain
more of their status by siphoning off yours.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a textbook definition. Yes. Well, I want to thank you for opening up and sharing that stuff for the first time publicly with us and our audience, because I know that's really...
I felt frustrated at times in the last few years with some of the deadheads online. I still trust this community. Like, this community, in a way, saved me. It was at the worst part, where we were going to go to Europe for a little while. And my husband, who's Australian and had only seen one dead show, which was the last Fairly Well show. And he's actually in the middle of the picture, because he's really tall. It's just hilarious. I'm like, your first dead show. And there you are in that J picture.
Yeah.
In the turquoise shirt. Anyway.
And then Bill Walton.
Exactly. He's not that tall, but yeah. But anyway, he said to me, no, we're going on tour. And that was 2018. I mean, and I had been seeing tons of shows, but that's when we just dropped everything, rented a truck, just drove and did tour. And it saved my life. It saved my life.
Wow.
That community saved my life. I don't know if you ever read the Salon article I wrote about that, but it's
I did. I'm going to go find that.
And about what I say, you all create something that I call bounteous presence, you know, among yourselves and then with us. And so then we create it. And it's this, you get these micro moments of love and connection with strangers you'll never see again. Yeah. And that's okay. There's no obligation.
Yeah.
It's micro love. And it's like micro dosing. It's micro love. And it's across generations. And and across all kinds of dimensions of diversity, but that saved me. That community saved me. It took me back to who I am. Nobody ever said, "What's your job?" Nobody.
Yeah.
In fact, I took a friend to a dead show. She hadn't been to one, and some guy was hitting on her, and she was like, "I'm not comfortable with this." And I said, "Ask him what he does for work." And she's like, "What do you do for work?" He was gone so fast.
Wow.
Like, deadheads don't ask each other what they do for work. Anyway, sorry.
That's so great. Well, I think the psychiatry and psychology need to really focus on that.
Yeah.
For all the psychiatry and psychology and your PhDs, it was connection with these people that are frigging strangers that saved you. Why? They need to figure out how they can describe why in their terms of academia and science and whatever. Like, fine.
For sure. But one more thing about this. It's like we define love way too narrowly.
Yeah.
I'm not getting into polyamory. I'm not, like, I'm just saying love is not just the thing that you feel with your family members and closest friends. I was, you know, back to the tokens, like, why do I wear this?
Yeah.
Because if I'm having a bad day, somebody, and I'm not my best self, somebody will see it and smile at me or give me the Jerry sign, you know, with the,
Totally.
And one day I was at a stoplight and I was like, just people were being terrible drivers and I just looked miserable. And I looked over and I have a Steely on the back of my car and I looked over and a guy, sorry, I'm so bad at doing that, went like this to me and smiled. And I was like, I'm okay. Right. Yep. But that's a micro moment of love. Like that's love.
And sometimes that's the thing that'll keep you going. And that's so important.
And we are overlooking it. We're missing those moments. They're all around us.
They're everywhere.
Seize them.
Yeah.
That's love. It's love. And so when people are like, "Oh, you're not dating anyone. You're alone." You know, I feel so bad for single friends because people make them feel like, "Oh, you must be miserable." Well, no, like I find love all the time.
Yeah.
In these moments. Yeah.
I find it at the grocery store. It's so funny. Like, I was wearing one of my professional wrestling t-shirts, and one of the guys that was bagging groceries was, you know, I don't know what the correct term that I'm supposed to say. He was short bus, you know. They have some guys bagging it.
Yeah.
And I walked by and he goes, "Roman Reigns, head of the table." He like screamed it out. And I was like, "Whoa, what is he?" And it's just a thing about Rhett. And I was like, I had my professional. And I was like, yeah. And I walked out once I got it, once I was not freaked out anymore. You know, I gave him like, "Yeah, Roman Reigns." Yes. And then I walked out of the store and I was just so lit up. Like, I don't even know if I was feeling that bad, but I was feeling like 75% better than I was before he did that, because it was just this little moment where he was like, "Yeah," and I was
"That's what I mean."
Yeah, that's all. That's what it's all about. Great. That's what it's all about.
Open. Yep.
Absolutely.
I don't remember the last 8 assholes that cut me off in traffic, but I remember that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's the important part, is to hold on to those moments and make them the bigger ones instead of.
Thank you guys for doing what you're doing, and you know, for having these conversations, but for making music that brings that out in people. I had Jonah and some of his friends over the other night. God, they're so beautiful. Like, the gift of having a kid in music school is that you get to hear beautiful music all the time. You know, and I live 4 miles away, so I'm the mom who gets to hear that. And they're out back on the patio all singing and play. It's beautiful. And I said to them, don't ever let anyone make you think that what you're doing being in music school is not important. It's the most important thing. Yeah. You know, my friend Susan Cain, who wrote Quiet, and also this new book, Bittersweet, which is so much about music. And
I think my wife has that book.
I think I told her to get it.
Okay, Bittersweet. You told her.
I think we texted about that. But it.
Yeah.
She says, and this is sort of full circle, she says, music is the closest thing to God.
Yeah.
And it is exactly what we need. It's exactly what we need. So don't ever let anyone make you think what you're doing isn't important. you're saving us, and you all have saved lives, so many lives. I cannot thank you enough, and I'm speaking on behalf of all of my people in the community. So thank you.
I appreciate it. You know, we at my lowest moments as a musician, when music couldn't save me, I used to go to comedy clubs. That's why I think me and Mike are so, because I was like, dude, comedy saved me from the bottom. He was like, music saved me from the bottom.
There's such overlap there, isn't there?
Well, and I would just like to say genuinely from the bottom of my heart, thank you for, you know, your vulnerability and your honesty. Seriously. and everything that you provide. And it's,
of course,
it went right to where it needed to go. And just thank you for sticking through and finding what you needed when you needed it, because everybody that is listening or watching needs to know that it's okay from the beginning of what we talked about to the end, embrace the mistakes, embrace the fact that we're not perfect. And there's so many things I wish we could have touched on even deeper, but yeah, this is the first set. Let's take a set break and then we'll come back and we'll do, you'll have to come back for second set of Amy.
Okay, I just got to run to the bathroom. I'll be right back.
No, not right now.
Thank you everyone for listening. We'll see you next time.
Osiris. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.